Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by Cleveland area attorney and Republican factotum, Jay Carson. Hey, Jay.
Good morning, Mike. Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm good to be happy to be here this morning.
You know, before we get started with our main stories, there's one thing I wanted to mention. I forgot to tell you this when we were talking before we started recording, but I think we should just say a word to acknowledge the passing of Elijah Cummings, who died this week. And of course, he was a very important and influential Democratic congressman from Maryland, and also an opponent of President Trump, a fairly fierce opponent, I think it would be safe to say. And they had some contentious exchanges for sure. But I will give credit where credit is due. President Trump put out a nice tweet about Representative Cummings. And so good for Donald Trump. It's always nice when he can sort of raise below his normal level on Twitter. But let's not make this about Donald Trump. Elijah Cummings was a great man. He did a lot of good for some very important causes, and he will be missed.
Well, there were a lot of tributes coming from Republican members who mm-hmm. served with him and sort of indicated that. And one of the things that struck me was that one particular congressman said they never had a harsh word outside of committee. That with Cummings, it was, you know, there was the business, it was the job to do, and then there was you know, personal afterwards. But that he could be a vociferous opponent. But he didn't make it personal with those other committee members.
So. Kind of leaving on the field. I think we could use a lot more of that for sure.
And all, I mean, I guess the other piece is that he is one of the last of the generation of leaders who really participated in the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. were really part of it and desegregating. And I think that's something that is also lost. There was an institutional memory there. And sort of the fact that this wasn't just abstract, or he actually lived it, participated in it, got beat up for it, literally.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I think Jay, we're going to actually formally open the show with Turkey, right? Syria, stuff. Yeah.
Our first story. Now we've had this has been kind of a crazy week, and hopefully I'll be able to capture in my summary what we're going on. But continued fallout from the U.S. withdrawal of troops from northern Syria. As you recall, we had about 1,000 troops in northern Syria protecting. There was a Kurdish group, the YPP. Trump sort of abruptly, I shouldn't say abruptly, there was the at one point he had signaled earlier that we were going to get out, but the pace was a surprise to everyone. What followed from there was, of course, a Turkish invasion, attack on these Kurdish areas, followed by a Trump declaration of sanctions against Turkey, followed by a offer of Mike Pence to go and visit Turkey to negotiate a resolution, which was then denied, followed by a ceasefire, which didn't necessarily really hold, then followed by a condemnation of the move by the House by a 354-60 vote. with 2-1 Republicans 2-1 going against the Trump decision of pulling out of Syria. And where we're left is the Senate, Lindsey Graham and
Chris Van Hollen,
Chris Van Hollen of Maryland have prepared a bill that is going to be stronger sanctions against Turkey, including specific Turkish officials like the Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
It's a tough one.
I just want to say it. Yeah. I always reverse the G.
I get that. Yeah, right. Absolutely. He's a weird one. But I wish he would be gone for so many reasons. That's only one of them. Yeah. But
yeah. But I mean, that I guess takes us to there's two questions that I think we should talk about. And the first is, one, there's the big international strategic implications of this. And I'm interested in your thoughts on just on a basic right thing, wrong thing. Or right thing done wrong way, pull out of Syria. And then the second question is the American political fallout from it.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jay, if I understand it correctly, this is sort of how I encapsulate it or see it in my head. Trump talks to Erdogan, and Erdogan says, well, we're going to invade northern Syria. And Donald Trump says, well, I don't think you should do that. And Erdogan says, well, we're going to do it anyway. And Donald Trump says, well, okay, I guess we'll pull out our forces then. And right away, I was like, whoa, boy, that's a signal of pretty intense weakness and capitulation. And then after we pull out our forces and say, well, we pulled them out, but we said, don't do that, even though we knew it was coming. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But we'll move our forces out so because we know you're going to. And then after the invasion and the humanitarian crisis, Trump threatens some really kind of weak tea sort of sanctions, which are then halted for a ceasefire that isn't really a ceasefire under conditions that essentially Erdogan gets everything that he wanted for essentially nothing. So it's hard to imagine the United States looking weaker out of this. I mean, a capitulation of this magnitude to Turkey, to anyone, is, I think, it sends us just a horrible signal. And that's, I think, why you saw that, you know, 354-60 vote. And there hasn't been a vote in the Senate because McConnell said we want something stronger than what the House did.
Right,
so,
right.
I mean,
yes, you and Mitch McConnell were very much on the same side.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's always, I got to say, when Mitch McConnell and I are on the same side or something, I tend to think there might be something to it, you know, or we're entering bizarro world. But to me, there's no way to spin this as anything but a colossal foreign policy blunder.
Well, in the interest of playing devil's advocate, I'll try.
Go ahead.
I agree with pretty much everything you said, that this was handled colossally poorly. I guess I get down to the root question of, is this a matter of this was going to happen sooner or later and we're better off just getting out, having sort of tearing the Band-Aid off? Because otherwise, what were the alternatives? And you and I have talked about this for a year now. I mean, my sense is the U.S. really lost its interest in Syria, ceded to the Russians, probably, you know, back during the Obama administration. We sort of did fig leaf things of putting in a couple thousand soldiers here and there under the auspices of helping to root out ISIS, in which the Kurds were our allies. But there was always this tension where we have, you know, essentially, you know, two allies, one Turkey, one the Kurds, one, you know, two friends who are fighting amongst each other, and to the extent that one wants to bomb the other out of existence. There was nothing good that we could do with 1,000 troops one way or another. And I'm not sure, you know, would Trump have been wiser to, try to call Erdogan's bluff, keep those troops in there, and you know he'll. Sure you're going to invade. Let's see what happens.
But isn't that? I mean, a classic Trumpian move is doubling down. But in this case, he didn't. He folded.
Yeah.
You know, and so to me, Erdogan says that, and your response should be, you go ahead and do that. We're going to send more troops in. And if you want to attack the United States of America, buddy, well, you're going to pay for it. And the way to handle, I mean, I can see your point that, well, maybe it's a good idea to get out altogether. I don't agree with that, but even if I did agree
really,
with that,
but,
yeah, but the way to do that would be then to work out some sort of behind the scenes agreement saying, listen, we're going to get out, but we cannot have you invade the moment we get out, and we cannot have Russian troops just still pouring in
right.
to fill the vacuum of our abandoned camps with these horrible images that are just, you know, the optics are tragic
right.
for us. So
Saigon 1975, right?
Yeah, so that's not something, and negotiating that maybe would have made sense if your goal is to get out and not look weak. But, you know, that's not what happened. And so this was, even if the goal was to get out quickly, this was handled horribly. And, you know, I really think that also Donald Trump, to me, in terms of foreign policy, doesn't seem to understand a lot. But one thing he doesn't seem to understand is the concept of a power vacuum, which strikes me as kind of
yeah.
odd, because it kind of has that sort of zero-sum logic, right? Our pulling back means someone else is inevitably going to step up. And we knew who that was. We knew it was going to be the Syrians, and we knew it was going to be the Russians. And they happened to be two of our, you know, our biggest opponents, at least in the region. And we just made it so much easier for them. And now we have a situation where in the Middle East, the Russians are talking to everyone. I mean, my gosh, the reception that Putin got in, you know, in Saudi Arabia and whatnot.
Sure.
I mean, they want to be the power brokers in the region. Now, they don't really have the geopolitical oomph to do that, but we sure are at least making it easier for them to make a big play in that region. And that's why for all the reasons that I understand why we might want to get out of the Middle East, I just don't think it's a viable option given the importance of the region.
Yeah. Well, first, you know me from my history, I'm, you know, to the extent that anything I think matters in particular, I'm much, much more on the neocon sort of engagement
yeah.
side
yeah.
When it comes to foreign policy. And I think that's also what is being evidenced by this vote in the House and the actions in the Senate. And I think it's significant that it's Lindsey Graham, who's has been one of Trump's chief supporters
yeah.
throughout his administration, is the one who's you know, sponsoring this bill. But you know, here's the other thing that makes it difficult is you can't spell NATO without Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And you know, we were in this strange position. We were threatened to be attacked by our own ally. And what happens if they do? I think Trump sees things, and I think you're right on the power vacuum thing. He doesn't necessarily think like that. I think he thinks in terms of good deal, bad deal. If he sees something, it's more of a business. And I don't know. This is sort of the armchair psychoanalysis, but sort of the look, if a business isn't performing, unit isn't, you know, get out of it, dump it. You know, that's what you do in the stock market. You don't keep sentimentally holding on to your losers just because you think they're going to turn around.
I think that falls apart because you also don't abandon a market when you know that your big opponent's going to swoop in and try to take up that market share. You know, so I think
it's
what you're doing
in business. I don't think it's a thing if you do abandon a market if you think you can't be competitive in it.
Well, I think you don't Well, again, you know, all of this, I think so many people are overanalyzing. I don't think Trump is thinking in terms of business strategy or any strategy. He has a conversation with someone and his gut tells him something and that's it. And so, I mean, I thought that.
Oh, and this is, yeah. And this has been, Trump has been saying this for some time about he wants to get out of these, as he calls, endless wars, which is sort of a parroting of what the old Democrat bumper sticker from the early 2000s was, right? I mean, so this is sort of always been a Trumpian sort of, you know, again, the Jacksonian kind of withdrawal. But I think the alacrity of which it happened that seemed to surprise yeah. everyone, I think that's the bigger problem. There may have been if you have to get out, there could have been a more orderly, more dignified way to do it. But orderly and dignified is not Trump's strong suit.
And not just that, but of course, the message it sends for abandoning the Kurds should be used to it. My God, everyone seems to abandon the Kurds.
I was going to note, you have like a special affinity for the Kurdish people, dating back to, I recall, in 1989 International Politics, you did a presentation on the Kurds.
I'm a fan of the Kurds. Yeah. But you know, but not only abandoning them, but also saying, well, you know, it's 7,000 miles away. Europe can deal with it. And I think it was one member of Congress who said, hey, you know, the people who bombed the or took down the World Trade Center were more than 7,000 miles away. So it's not necessarily all that great to be so cavalier about this sort of thing. So you and I agree on this, this sort of isolationist kind of Fortress America thinking. That was out of date even in the 1950s, certainly. That's kind of that's like 19th century thinking. And it's just utterly ridiculous and short-sighted and is ultimately to the detriment of not just the United States, but the cause of, you know, freedom and democracy in the world, which I think should still mean something.
Yeah. I'm going to throw one more, again, as a devil's advocate sort of thing, just to look at the complexity of this, because I think it is more complex than it's being portrayed in the media. And that is, this is a dispute between, one, an authoritarian strongman who certainly doesn't share our values, and that
Donald Trump?
Erdogan.
Trump.
Turkey does not share Western values in terms of it used to be more so, but is becoming less so. I think I read somewhere that, you know, Turkey has like the most per capita number of journalists imprisoned, and you know, which is never a good sign for the health of your regime. Likewise, the YPP, who are the Kurdish forces, may or may not be, you know, any saints either. They are. A little terroristy. Have ties to the PKK, which had ties to other terrorist organizations, but they were an ally of convenience in fighting ISIS. And the argument would go, well, listen, they understood going in that this was a alliance of convenience for the purposes of beating back ISIS. And you know, this was understood to be sort of a transactional arrangement. Whereas NATO is a more permanent arrangement. Now, again, that's the devil's advocate kind of argument.
Sure.
But I think it's important to think this isn't just there are bigger things here than, I mean, Trump acted dumbly and impulsively. But there's a bigger problem here, regardless of whether it will be President Trump or someone else addressing it.
And I think that's a good point you make, because you mentioned transactional relationships. And that, to me, seems to be how President Trump sees almost all of our relationships. And that's very different, especially when we're talking about our relationship with, you know, Europe especially with Europe and some other countries as well. And I think that's what a lot of people are concerned about, that idea that that's not really, at least entirely, how our foreign policy has been. And we damage, you know, if other countries, if our main allies can't count on us and just expect it, you know, we're going to be entirely transactional, then all of a sudden a lot of things, you know, fall apart, and that's not good.
Sure. It's the demonstration effect is what they used to call it.
There you go.
So,
yeah.
So, well, moving on from that to impeachment this week. And I'm not sure if this is sort of a running feature. Last week, U.S. Ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, testified behind closed doors to Adam Schiff's committee. He sort of stuck to the story, and that makes it sound sort of nefarious.
Go ahead.
He sort of confirmed his previous statements that, as he understood, there was no quid pro quo between withholding aid and any sort of investigation of Ukrainian either participation in the 2016 election or digging up dirt in aid of a 2020 election. Then White House Acting White House Chief of Staff then quite helpfully, Mick Mulvaney jumped in to say, well, no, it's we do this all the time. And there was a he didn't say quid pro quo, but he said that it was tied to investigations of Ukraine's role in the hacking of the Democratic emails in 2016, which I don't want to get into this whole thing because it gets pretty weird and complicated.
Sure.
And a little conspiratorial. But the gist of it is that the conclusion that the DNC emails were hacked by the Russians came from a company called Crowdsource, which Trump contends is related to Ukrainian entities, which has yet to be really proven. So there's that, and there was the push of well, can you trust Crowdsource? Because, you know, were they giving us the straight dope, and was it really the Ukrainians who hacked this? It all seems a little academic maybe at this point, but Mulvaney then walked back his statements.
He ran it back. Yeah.
I can see a line here. Cause this is what I'm trained to do. Right. Of saying that, you know, look, I didn't say there was a quid pro quo.
Okay. Let me stop you there.
Yes.
Mulvaney's exact words were, did he also mention to me in the past, the corruption related to the DNC server? Absolutely, no question about it, but that's it, and that's why we held up the money. Now, that is the definition of a quid pro quo. We held up the money because of the corruption related to the DNC server. There is no way you can parse that sentence and not have it come out as a clear political quid pro quo. Now, that doesn't relate
to... I can parse the hell out
well,
of
it. Well, yeah, well, that would be just your lawyerly tricks, but any reasonable person. Now we should point out that that doesn't involve the Biden and Burisma thing.
Right.
I mean, he made that a clear separation, but still, and then he said, well, we do this all the time. So...
And I think we do.
Well, to a certain extent, not for campaign help.
So the difference is whether it's you know, whether he had the discretion to do it, right? If it's congressionally approved funds that are supposed to go and by a certain date, and you have the discretion to hold them up or you don't. But
so and then, you know, and you mentioned that Sondland testified that there was no quid pro quo. Actually, I believe he testified that is what he was told by Trump.
Exactly.
But he didn't know if that was actually the case or not. He was just repeating what he was told by the president. So basically
texted by the president. Yeah. So
and I think that's important. He also, Sondland mentioned, right, that, you know, he didn't even realize that the Bidens were connected to Burisma, which is obviously ludicrous because there's no plausible deniability for him, because Giuliani been pushing this for a long time, and it's been all over the media, especially the right-wing media. So essentially his defense is, I was incredibly out of the loop and totally uninformed and like the worst, dumbest diplomat ever. And that was just a ridiculous defense, but I guess it's all he had. He was too busy redecorating the residence, apparently.
The other thing, all we know from Sondland is what was in his prepared statement that was released.
So
we don't know to the extent there were follow-up questions. We don't know to the extent we assume that he said everything that was in the prepared statement. Yeah.
So let me see.
Said he hasn't, but.
Let me see, Jay, if I kind of have a good handle on this. So you mentioned the closed-door hearings, but we know in these hearings that both Democrats and Republicans are represented on these committees, and both sides, according to, you know, people who are in these hearings have been given unlimited question time with witnesses. It's like, I think they said an hour back. So this is in-depth stuff, and both sides have an opportunity. And to me, right away, this call that this is illegitimate, there's no due process, that I think is the grasping at straws there, essentially. I mean, this is an initial investigation, and the idea that you would let everyone know, say, well, what's his story? I want to make sure I have this, so that way we can coordinate our message and that sort of thing. Can you imagine if the police provided that sort of due process, you know, in their investigations? I mean, it would, you know, it's a ridiculous argument, I think, especially given the fact that multiple Republicans are there and have an opportunity to question these witnesses. So that to me is an illegitimate argument, actually.
Well, I think you're maybe you're looking at it the wrong way. And my argument isn't that it's the process is illegitimate because there's somehow no due process.
Okay.
But the I think the issue is this isn't a criminal trial. This isn't a grand jury. The jury that you eventually have to convince is the American people. And if you're proceeding behind closed doors and sort of leaking things selectively, there's going to be a lot of suspicion that, look, is this really something important or is this just political shenanigans? I think if you want to, and I'm not saying it's, that makes the process illegitimate, but I think it certainly does. It's bad optics, right?
Okay.
If this is something that is so important to our nation to hear all this, to know all this, to find out what's going on, but we're not going to let the press in.
I agree with you.
What message does that send? And I think the message it sends is this is political, and we're going to, you know, it's just a Democrat is trying to play gotcha, Republicans trying to protect them.
I agree with you on the public, on how people who are inclined to perceive it that way, that makes it easier for them to do that. But I think you would agree with me that you can get a lot more real work done if you don't have the cameras on you all the time and are concerned that every single thing you say is going to be used by your political opponents in a re-election campaign. And I think that's why they're doing it.
That's what makes democracy tough.
I mean, absolutely. And I agree with you on that entirely. And you know, there was also this report that from Mitch McConnell, telling the Senate to expect the trial before Thanksgiving, and then you know maybe we can get a motion to dismiss before Christmas. And I guess McConnell would want that because
now he's saying to hunker down.
Yeah, because Pelosi responded to that by saying, you know, we're not really working on Mitch McConnell's time frame here. So, I think that was I'm not really exactly sure what the point was in that. So, you know, and like you, there are a lot, we don't know a lot of things at this point, right? And we are just getting sort of these secondhand accounts what the prepared statements are, and I think that's important. You know, it seems to me that what I can glean at this point is multiple witnesses have testified, or at least prepared remarks, saying essentially that U.S. foreign policy toward Ukraine was being conducted not so much by the professional diplomatic staff, but to what really is sort of an unusual degree by what have been called the three amigos.
Someone who was
Sondland, who was ambassador to the European Union. And by the way, that doesn't include Ukraine, Kurt Volker, the envoy to Ukraine at the time, and then Energy Secretary Rick Perry, who's resigning now. And also,
two of those people are, you would say, the typical diplomatic staff.
Absolutely. Yeah. But then also multiple witnesses have testified that President Trump's personal attorney played a significant role in foreign policy toward Ukraine, and Giuliani said that himself, essentially, and this is something that apparently caused a lot of tension because, you know, your personal attorney is not supposed to be an agent of U.S. foreign policy. In fact, I believe that might actually be illegal. And John Bolton, among others, was pretty worked up about that sort of thing. So I think that's kind of, I'm not going to say that's what we know, but that seems to be the story that's emerging based on these bits and pieces we're getting from the testimony.
Yeah, no, that seems right, and I would think that what the gloss I would add was Giuliani. It seems from what we've gleaned, the diplomats viewed Giuliani as this was the guy, the gatekeeper to Trump.
Right.
Less so, I think, of Giuliani sort of running foreign policy. More of look, Trump eventually runs foreign policy, but he won't believe any of us or trust any of us. So we got to get Giuliani's buy-in.
Yeah, and Giuliani has all
which is a little different than saying Giuliani's operating foreign policy.
Giuliani seems to have been pushing a lot of interests of his own, and there's a lot of there's a lot of things that sort of interconnect.
You're spending
here.
A lot of time in Ukraine, more than you'd expect.
Yeah,
personal attorney.
If you were going to do one of these, you know, like in a crime show where the detective has the little dots and the pieces of string connecting, there it would look like some sort of a nightmarish connection. Yeah, we really should. That would be wild. But
we should like make our own thing and like do the string. One thing I do want to come back to, because I think this is important, and this is maybe me just playing lawyer a little bit. But on the quid pro quo, I think you're incorrect. I think saying,
okay,
we're not going to release money because they haven't done X, Y, or Z is not a quid pro quo. A quid pro quo is going to the Ukrainians and saying, if you want this, you have to give us this information, then we'll release the aid.
Let me ask
now, again,
you then.
You can say there's an implication there, but
okay.
but it's the Ukrainians so far had said they didn't know the aid was being withheld, which is, you know, sort of if so, there's not a very good quid.
I'm trying to understand what you're saying here. So when Mulvaney said, that's why we held up the money.
Yeah, but if you have to also look at the rest of that sentence, there was a lot of things that preceded.
All right, the rest of the sentence
discussion
was
there's corruption. There is other engagement by other European powers.
Right. So he said, absolutely no question about that. Past corruption related to the DNC server. Absolutely no question about that. That's why we held up the money. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you stick with your story that there's no quid pro quo. That's fine. You could make an argument. I think it is quite possibly,
what I'm saying is for there to be a quid pro quo, it's like in law, it's a conspiracy. You need to have two parties conspiring.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
This is a unilateral decision saying, I'm not satisfied with how they've performed or what they've provided to us.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
Therefore, I'm withholding aid unilaterally.
Okay.
It's different from saying or proposing, if you do this, I will give you this.
Okay.
I'm all about clear thinking.
Sure.
And making sure that
I see what you're saying. It's still corruption. It's just not quid. It's just doesn't fit
right,
the technical
good,
definition of quid pro quo, because holding up congressionally authorized money to achieve personal political ends is still corrupt. It's just not. Okay. Fair enough. I will agree with you on that. I don't have a problem with that. All right. Well, are we ready to move on, Jay?
We are.
Before we do, I'm so sorry. Before we do, I just tried to move us along, but I wanted to say one other thing. You know, some people are talking about support for impeachment, and support for impeachment has been rising. In fact, now there seems to be a slight majority. And I know you don't follow a lot of media on the left. I do, of course. And so
I'm sort of forced to.
Well,
really.
I know we could, but you know, a lot of on the left are saying, well, see, now we can kind of move ahead. But to me, I wanted to point out one thing. It's not so much about overall support. It's more about, support by party. And support by party, so it's only like 12% of Republicans maybe support an impeachment, at least, you know, the process. But to me, more importantly, and this is from, I'm sure, how Pelosi is seeing it, is what do the numbers look like in those, I believe it was 31 House Democratic districts won by Trump in 2016?
Right.
And I bet you those numbers might look a little differently, because given the fact that we know, and I've said this before, but I wanted to kind of push back against this movement on the left saying, well, the public is with us. Well, the public in general doesn't matter. What matters is, you know, how is this going to affect our control on the levers of power so that we can do good things for people as we see them on the left? And so I think it's important to keep that in mind. And I'm sensitive to the argument that sometimes you just have to do the right thing because it's the right thing and damn the consequences. And that's why a lot of people voted for Donald Trump, you know, right? Saying, well, the right thing is getting these judges in. And so it's a balancing act, but I don't think people should be so quick on the left to jump to the conclusion of, hey, the public's with us now, because I think that's a pretty questionable assumption.
I would say I was actually going to maybe make the opposite point that there's everything is always connected, of course. And, you know, the idea that, you know, Trump really couldn't have picked a worse time on this Syria withdrawal to alienate people whose support he needs. namely people like Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham, and all those House members that voted to condemn the withdrawal. Again, does it necessarily change how those folks vote on impeachment? Not at this point, but it's one of those. It's you know, one more headache, right? It's you know, it goes from, hey, you know, we're with you, we're staying with you 100% of, oh, geez, now, you know, now, so
yeah,
I think there's a little bit of erosion. Again, I don't see it actually changing any outcomes at this point. But down the road, you know, you may look back at it and say that's when it started to change, I guess. So moving on, about things that have changed, the Democratic debate hosted yet another debate. And at this point, you know, Mike, I think I would say that Senator Warren seemed to be appear as the front runner.
Yeah.
She was treated as the front runner. And in light of numerous things, the Biden flubs, some of the issues with his son, the Sanders heart attack, she sort of seems to be the last woman standing at this point, and was very much treated by the event coordinators as the front runner. My impression was Biden did not do himself any favors. There were some sort of gaffes, slips, weird Bidenisms, where you weren't sure exactly what he was talking about, where he said things about how he was proud of his son's judgment, and those kind of, again, just general weirdness. I don't think that he moved the needle particularly well. You know, and you could say, well, he didn't need to for a while, but he's starting to get to that point now. The other thing I found interesting was that Amy Klobuchar has sort of taken up the mantle as the, you know, seriously, how much is this going to cost wing of the party, at calling out Elizabeth Warren on some of her proposals, such as the Medicare, sort of her version of Medicare for All, and Green New Deals and so forth, and just explaining, listen, there's no way that you can pay for this program with the wealth tax or the other proposals you've thrown out there. It's you know, you please admit this would require a large middle class tax hike. Now, so that's sort of my just sort of snapshot. I didn't go into like real deep detail on who said what, but that, I mean, I guess, is that from your view? Are you seeing the same thing I am?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I've always felt that that Bernie Sanders is kind of the less detailed and more honest version of Elizabeth Warren, you know, in the sense that Bernie
calls it socialism.
Yeah. Well, Bernie's willing to say, yeah, taxes are going to go up. And now Warren's in this position where she's realizing, I think, that, you know, it's a lot harder to be the center of all these attacks. And I think she did a good job and so forth. But, you know, we can see some things coming a little more clearly into place. I think one thing that I noticed particularly was, Pete Buttigieg being much more aggressive, because I think he sees an opening here as Biden potentially falters. Now, it's important to say, though, still at this point, Biden is still the front runner in the polls. And yeah, while Warren has gained a lot, you know, there's still a good, you know, 6 points or so, I think, between them at least at this point in time. And obviously still it's Biden and Sanders right now. Then there's a big gap. And then there's Biden and Warren. Then there's a big gap. Then there's Sanders. And then you kind of have Buttigieg and Harris. And after that, it's a cast of thousands kind of hanging around at, you know, like 2% or below. But what's interesting to me is looking not so much at the debates, but looking at the state of the race in some other areas that I think are important. So,
I think you know where you're going, because I was just going to say it too. But
well, a lot's been made about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar's endorsements of Bernie. I guess that'll be helpful. Yeah, it can't hurt. But what I'm looking at is geeky stuff. I'm looking at who has field offices in Iowa and how much. Well, it turns out that Pete Buttigieg has 22 field offices in Iowa, and that's more than anyone else. Warren's second at 19, Biden is third at 17. And in fact, Buttigieg and Warren are tied for having the most field offices in the first four Democratic primary states at 47. And those states are Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. And also, when you look at fundraising, you know, you have Sanders, Warren.
Well, that was where I was going
to go. Yeah, and then Buttigieg, because all of those things are connected. And so it seems to me that Buttigieg's campaign right now is just, he's got a good amount of money, and he's focusing intently on those first couple states because he knows that Iowa is a huge opportunity to exceed general media expectations, get that boost, and kind of move that into New Hampshire. So I really think that he has, of anyone who's not named, Biden or Sanders, I really think he's positioned himself very well to be in the running well down the line.
Let me put it in perspective with the actual numbers, is that Joe Biden's campaign's cash on hand is $9 million. That is not much at all as these presidential elections go. The next one is Elizabeth Warren with $25 million.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bernie Sanders, who has... Oh,
I think in the third quarter, Sanders actually raised a little bit more than
61.
Cash on hand. Yeah. I'm not sure. I just have the third quarter fundraising. But now Warren and Sanders are helped a little bit by the fact that they can use their Senate money for that. And that's Biden's been talking about that. But still, I think
this money's money.
Yeah. The enthusiasm is. And if you actually look at the I think the one poll that matters a lot to the candidates right now, you look at the Iowa polls right now, Warren's slightly ahead of Biden, and then you have Sanders and Buttigieg basically kind of as a top four, and then there's everyone else. And so I really think going forward, it looks to me like it's going to be a battle between those four and everyone else. I'm not going to say that, you know, Harris is trying, but I don't see anyone else really breaking through at this point, given what we know about resources and the ground game and all of those things that are so, you know, really important when you get down to Iowa and New Hampshire.
Yeah. Oh, let me updated numbers. Sanders had 33.7 million, Elizabeth Warren 25.7, and Buttigieg a surprising 23.4 million.
Yeah. Yeah, he's been doing really well in fundraising, and a lot of people say, well, his national poll numbers aren't all that great, and certainly, absolutely, but then when you look at his Iowa numbers, that looks a lot better, actually. So, and I think people need to understand how the strategy works. If you're not one of those top two big names, a lot of times focusing intently on those first couple states and getting that boost, that's the way you kind of bootstrap your way into the real running. And I think that seems to me to be the strategy. And as I mentioned before, I like an awful lot about Buttigieg. Now, Booker probably would be my choice before him, but Booker, I think, is not going to be a factor going forward. So I am on the P train, I think, at this point, given who I think is viable.
All right. I guess moving then our last story I want to hit, and this
before
is
before we get to that
story. We got to do something before that. Though,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Before we have some new supporters, and I've been off the show for a couple of weeks. I just wanted to take a minute to thank them. We have Jim, who's a new supporter on Patreon. We have Peter as well, and Peter wrote, "Thanks to everyone for the podcast. I look forward to your podcast to fuel my workout." I like this. Wow. "I wanted to encourage Mike to lay down some pomp on Jay. So often, Jay calls out Mike directly with some of his bad judgment, but too often, Mike lets Jay go wrong incorrectly.
Oh, no.
My brother joined in with Jay going on the record that Hillary will run again, and I rubbed it in his face, as he deserved. Mike, you need to call out Jay on how silly of an idea it was to think Hillary would run again. Democrat derangement syndrome. Am I right?" Okay, so I guess I just called you out kind of indirectly on that, Jay.
I'll admit, at this point, it appears that Hillary Clinton is not running.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say. But
never say never. Never count her out.
Oh, okay, yeah. Right. Anyway, he said, "You guys deserve support. Thanks for your time and effort." Also, I wanted to send a shout out to Armand. And he became a supporter on Patreon a while back from Iceland, actually.
Wow.
And yeah, and there was this whole thing about I tried to send them a mug and it couldn't go to Iceland, so I had to send it to me, and then I got to go to the post office and have it sent to Iceland. It was a big mess, and I felt really bad about it. Basically, it's taken like 5 months for his mug to get to him. And not only that, but I totally slaughtered the pronunciation of his name. I'm sensitive to these things. And I actually asked him, could you send me a recording of you saying your name? And he did that, which was so cool of him. And then I realized that my mouth cannot make certain sounds. And this was one of them. So I just tried my best. But he had a great, he said, you know, I've never been a person who pays for something I can get for free. But after you guys decided to stop having ads on the show, I felt the need to support my favorite podcast. It gets me through the long and dark winters here in Iceland. Keep on making them, and I will keep on listening and supporting. P.S. I'm looking forward to making the Politics Guys mug my main mug at the office, where I can be found yelling at my coworkers about how great your show is. So,
thank you. That really means a lot. Yeah,
absolutely. And then finally, I wanted to really single out executive producer Andra Masker. She recently helped us out in a huge way with our recent ad campaign. And of course, you know, enlarging our audience base is critical to keeping the show going in the long haul. And so Andra's support is just extraordinarily generous, as well as I think an indication of how much she believes in what we're all about. So thank you so much, Andra. We are proud to have you as an executive producer on the show. And finally, Jay, I want to let everyone know that this week's bonus content, which normally is just for people who support the show on Patreon, we're making it free for everyone this weekend.
So, wow.
Yeah, you know, it's like remember like those free preview weekends that used to be on like Showtime and HBO, and
right,
that's where we
right.
get so excited back in the day. Well, kind of like that. So all you have to do to access it is head over to our Patreon site. That's patreon.com/politicsguys. And this week, Jay and I are doing a bonus show where we're going to be listening or responding to a bunch of listener questions. We got all kinds of stuff queued up: term limits, sexual misconduct, the government corruption, if millennials should have any hope for the future, or they should be just feel like they're doomed. So, and Kristen's doing the quick take this week. She's going to be responding to a listener who can't understand her support for Donald Trump. And also, and why she thinks the Democratic alternatives are all worse than another 4 years of Donald Trump. So if you're interested in that, this is a great opportunity to get a sense of what our bonus content is like. And again, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys for that. Okay, Jay, I know we have one more story we want to cover this week. So
one more, and this is pretty quick, but I think that, you know, as we exchange emails sort of on usually Thursdays or Fridays about what stories we're going to talk about, and you encapsulated this as it's a wonderful phrase. The Senate's failure to override Trump's veto of the revocation of emergency declaration.
Yeah. How malicious.
So if you're following along at home, what happened, of course, is this goes to the Trump border wall funding, where he declared a national emergency, which would allow him to spend money that he could not otherwise spend on the wall. So then Congress came back and said, no, you can't do that, and essentially revoked that emergency declaration, which it's able to under the statute, under the emergency fund mm-hmm. statute, which Trump then vetoed, which then goes back to the Senate then to try to override the veto, and they failed to do that. So, long story short, Trump will still be spending these funds, but the vote was 53-36, and President Trump lost about 7 votes since the last time this happened a couple months back. So you know, you can say, is that a symptom of the turkey and the impeachment and all this other stuff, possibly, or just general Trump frustration? But
yeah, Jay, I wanted to comment on that.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on it. But I think it's just, I love just sort of the convoluted nature of this.
Well, you know, both times there were 53 votes to override, but the difference is back on May 2nd, the first time they voted to override, it was, there were only 6 Republicans that voted against the president to override his veto. This time, 10 of them did. And that's 19% of the Republicans in the Senate. So, you know, I think you might be right. That's a sign of, you know, kind of an increasing pushback, at least on these sort of issues, obviously. But to me, kind of, and the reason why it still stayed at 53 is that back in May, there were only two members that didn't vote. And this time there were 11, and a lot of them were presidential candidates. So, you know, who were doing other things, obviously. But, you know, this ties into a story we really haven't talked about, and that's the budget. Back at the end of the budget year, which ends at the end of September, Congress passed a continuing resolution, which funds everything at its current level until November 21st. Now, at this point, the Senate has only passed one of the 12 spending years for fiscal year 2020, which, again, started on October 1st of this year. And last time, Jay, as I'm sure you'll recall, everything got passed fairly expeditiously because basically they just threw a bunch of money at everyone that totally destroyed the budget caps that were put into place a few years back in the Obama years. Now, this time, the Trump people say he's not going to sign anything that doesn't have the additional $5 billion he wants for the wall, or maybe he will sign, but then he'll just do another end around on Congress by again reallocating defense spending allocated by Congress in the budget using the emergency authority. And then Congress will, you know, disapprove of that. Then the president will veto it. And then the Senate will not have the votes to override again, essentially. Now, at the same time, Senate Democrats are proposing legislation that would disallow presidents from reallocating congressionally appropriated funds. But it looks like
they sort of already did that, though. I mean,
it looks that that's actually not going to come to a vote in the floor because McConnell's not going to let it. But it seems to me that that's an entirely reasonable measure to take. And in fact, I think you and I might actually agree that it's probably a good thing that if Congress allocates funds, that the president doesn't get to do with them what he wants.
Yeah, right. And my point would be, that's sort of already the law. The exception being the national emergency,
right,
which he's got to do. But then they come back, and so I would probably disagree with that. We still ought to have some sort of national emergency provision in there.
Yeah, but it's basically, it's incredibly broad. And
for national emergencies.
Yeah, and this would actually be, I think the problem is it's very difficult to define national emergency. And in the past, we've just sort of relied on the sense and decency of the president in doing that. And while that would be a big mistake this time out with this guy. But if you can't define that clearly enough, then what you can do, though, is put in more constraints on the president's ability to act longer term when a national emergency has been declared. So still allow him to declare it, but
you have to get it reauthorized.
Exactly. Yeah. And not make it so that it essentially requires 2/3 of Congress to do that, basically. So, yeah, and I think that's kind of
I get where you're coming from. It could be a 50% up-down vote to revoke the authority rather than this situation, you would revoke it sort of unilaterally, but then that would be subject to a veto.
Yeah, and so that's the problem.
But wouldn't this new legislation be subject to a veto anyway?
Veto, yeah. So again, now
aren't we kind of back where we started from?
Yeah. So that would be the big problem, obviously. I guess the only way to get Trump to not veto it would be to say that, well, it would only go into place for the next president, and then maybe he'd be, I don't know, a little more inclined to sign it, but maybe not. So it's difficult because, again, presidents are going to be likely, Democrat or Republican, to veto any legislation that constrains presidential power, which, by the way, the power was expanded because Congress decided in its infinite wisdom to give the president more of this authority. You know, this and the trade authority and a bunch of other things that President Trump and before him, President Obama and so forth have done only happened because Congress decided to pass legislation that, in fact, expanded presidential authority that presidents were all too happy to sign into law.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. That said, I'm still comfortable with the statute as it stands, because I think the Trump funding, I mean, we're talking again about $5 billion, $3 billion, $5 billion, and it's given the cost of if you had a real not to, you know, I'm not trying to judge Trump's declarations, but a real national emergency, and couldn't approve the funds when you needed. I think that's just kind of cost of doing business.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a difference.
I mean, I think you put up with some, like, you know, all right, that's an emergency because you want the executive to have that authority and flexibility when stuff does go really bad.
Sure, absolutely. But arguing that, well, there is an emergency, and so our solution to it is to build a wall that will take multiple years. Well, to me, then it's not really, that's not really the response to an emergency, right? And, you know, when the president himself says, well, I could do this some other way, but I choose to do it this way. I mean,
By that rationale,
yes,
is global warming an emergency?
Well, I mean, yeah, and that's why I think you can make the argument that it would not fit under the definition of the national emergency legislative authority that's been granted to the president. So while it's a crisis in terms of emergency, how the legislation is written, I would say no, that a Democratic president coming in who would invoke the national emergency statute to act against global warming, I think that would be every bit as illegitimate as Donald Trump doing it to build a wall.
Okay.
There you go.
Good answer.
I like to think I'm consistent. Anyway, on that consistent note, we will close. But again, as soon as Jay and I are done doing today's show, remember, we're going to be doing that bonus show, and that will be free for everyone this weekend, including Kristen's quick take. And again, go to patreon.com/politicsguys to check that out. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can at mail@politicsguys.com. There's also a Facebook page where you can message us, and we post all kinds of stuff throughout the week. That's facebook.com/politicsguys page. We are also on Twitter @politicsguys. And hey, if you haven't subscribed to the show yet, it would really help us out. Please do so on your podcast app of choice. And if you could say nice things about us, whether it's in reviews, ratings, or just to general people, just grab them on the street. That's fine.
People
whatever
on the street. Yeah.
You know, don't get too crazy about it. But yeah, we would appreciate it. Thanks so much. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andre Masker, and Daniel Toe. Today's show is produced by Michael Baranowski and Jay Carson. We'll be back with a new show on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us.